So I find that I have a lot of notes for The Matrix Reloaded, which I did not expect. And I think it's just because I needed to do something during the action sequences, because during every one, I got like bored halfway through.
The action sequences are too long.
They are all start very exciting, very good. There's something cool and different in every one. But yeah, like this movie, this is a really good hour and a half movie that was made 2 hours and 15 minutes.
I mean, I would even say that getting it under 2 hours would have been enough. You know, there's a certain degree to which the action sequences, I mean, they're very well done. They're very fun to watch to a certain point.
And then it's like the twins fucking get up again.
Right.
And then they get up again. It's like when a little kid is like telling a story, you know, the.
But I wonder though, and that, you know, I'm glad we had the same reaction to them. But at the same time, I do wonder if the action sequences, especially in The Matrix Reloaded, are primarily there to disguise the fact that this is not a very good script.
Mm.
You know, because really I think that, you know, I was a little bored, you know, during some of the action sequences as they went on and on and on. But at the same time, I don't really feel like I was all that interested or invested in what happened in the movie. And frankly, to a large degree, I don't know that anything really did happen.
And I didn't quite understand. Like, there is – it's edited weirdly. There's a lot of – when plot is happening, it's told very unclearly. There's a bunch
which
of –
which could be part of the point.
But, you know, here's the thing. Like, because the beginning of the original Matrix was very cryptic.
Yeah.
It was weird. There was a lot of what the hell is going on. But in the sense that it was about somebody who was first getting their sense that there was something very deeply wrong with the world and seeing little bits, you know, suddenly becoming bigger and bigger until, you know, the truth is revealed.
Yeah.
And so for it to be – this wasn't necessarily cryptic, which I'm fine with cryptic and ambiguous. This was just – I felt like I honestly had to look and just, you know, to say, oh my God, did I watch the third movie instead, because I missed something here. It felt like I missed a chapter of the story, and whether that meant that I should have watched the Animatrix and I should have, you know, read the comic book and, you know, listened to all of the back lore – or I don't know what.
I don't know when the Animatrix came out. I think it might have been after. I'm not sure, but I could look it up. But frankly, I don't think it matters all that much because we're not going to cover it on this season of Trek About Presents. But, you know, and I think that...
Or probably ever.
Yeah, we're not completists on this at all. I think that the primary... I mean, I liked The Matrix Reloaded, and I think that it is a good... It's probably the best second chapter of the Matrix trilogy that we could get. My problem with it is really that I don't know why it exists. And you know, the thing about it is I mentioned last week that the Matrix was sort of like this, you know, it was a surprise hit. It was kind of like in that same Star Wars vein where, you know, we know that the original Star Wars was not designed as a trilogy. It was designed as a discrete movie with a story, and it ended. And I feel like whether or not the Wachowskis had other chapters in mind when they made The Matrix, they may have. I think because, you know, we're looking at this from a point of view that was 22 years after the original Star Wars. So at this point, trilogies were an established thing.
Yeah.
Sequels were much more of a business decision than they were back in the 70s and 80s. And certainly, you know, that's come around to such a degree now that, you know, movie sequels are planned out years in advance.
And I mean, stuff like, I think it is fairly clear that if they didn't, you know, have all of the details of Zion, for example, sketched out by the time they made the first movie, they had a pretty good idea of what Zion was, how the war started, you know, stuff that, you know, for one reason or another didn't make it quite into the first movie that they knew. And so I guess if it's, you know, if they didn't have the idea for what the plots of the next two movies had, they have some idea of where this would go.
At the same time, though, I feel like, you know, we have to talk about the big reveal at the end that this is all cyclical and that the Matrix has been – Zion has been destroyed five times before, and there's been other ones. And, you know, this is sort of like a programmed thing to release tension in the structure of the Matrix and all that kind of stuff, right?
In
and
a way,
it's – that kind of feels like, to me, the same thing that happened at the end of Return – or at the end of Empire Strikes Back when they hit upon the idea that Darth Vader was Luke's father. It doesn't feel like it was planned. Which is not a bad thing. I like improvisation that way.
I mean, it's the kind of – you know, that plot particular – it reminds me a lot of 1984, and, you know, you can tell that that's where they cribbed from.
Yeah.
Because they have the rebellion of the party is orchestrated by the party members. So you have the whole chosen one thing orchestrated by the machines, you know, in a way. And so everybody – you know, all the rebels follow this thing that the machines have already planned for, you know, and it's there – I mean, it does make sense in a way. It is an interesting concept, but I don't know. I kind of liked a lot of the one-on-one conversations in here, even if they didn't necessarily mean anything. Like, for example, you know, the Merovingian speech on choice and, you know, freedom. I wasn't listening to any of that, but at the same time, seeing him, you know, it was a cool scene. You know, it's a very... You know, I like the way it was staged. You know, I like the way he's chewing the scenery and stuff like that. You know, same the scene with the architect. I didn't really care any of what he was saying, but the background was really interesting. The multiple Neos, you know, those were all really cool. It was a cool bit to watch.
You know, that's interesting because I actually had almost an exact opposite reaction to that. I was really interested in what the architect was saying. I was really interested in the conversations with the Oracle and the conversations with the Merovingian. Like, to me, the heart of, you know, if the Matrix is a very sort of a bog standard, you know, synthesis of a lot of different sort of dystopian and cyberpunk elements that are done in a very unique way and are done in a very Wachowski way, are done in a very, very interesting way. I think that this movie is obviously about, you know, sort of mysticism. It's about the cyclical nature of history. You know, there's a lot of things in here that, for the most part, I think that the conversations themselves, these feel like conversations that these machine characters have had before. And of course, at the end of the movie, it's kind of implied that they, you know, the Oracle has talked to five other Neos. You know, the Merovingian has probably had this happen a lot of other times.
And in a way that can, you know, actually, let's tie this into Groundhog Day. The Oracle knows what choice everybody's going to make because this has happened five times before.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, don't think that I am discounting the philosophy behind that because, yes, obviously there are some points about choice and freedom that they do want to make in this series.
Well, you know, not to cut you off, but I think the other thing that makes me realize too is that, you know, the architect is talking about how the bug in the Matrix is human free will, is human choice, and they can't program around that. And so if you look at that in that way and you say, okay, at the same time, this has happened five times before. The Oracle has had this conversation before. The Merovingian, the architect have had this conversation before. And they know what Neo is going to do. In a certain sense, it seems to be arguing that while choice is a bug in the Matrix and while they can't, you know, program around everything that a human being will do, at the same time, in the big things, they seem to be saying that they know exactly what the humans are going to do.
Well, in a way, I mean, the choice that they give Neo at the end is either, you know, well, you know, everybody dies or everybody but 23 people die. I mean, it's kind of a non-choice choice. I mean, there's the...
Do you want to save the princess? Yes or no? No. Are you sure you don't want to save the princess? Like, yeah, it's kind of video game thing.
You know, in philosophy, it's called, you know, a Hobson's choice, which is basically, you know, take it or leave it. It's not really a choice, but, you know.
How do you want to be executed?
Yeah. And see what this, you know, and I find the interesting thing is that because he says, you know, the previous one, when he talks about his love for Trinity. The architect does say the previous ones just had a general love for humanity. They didn't have a specific incarnation. And, I mean, this movie makes it clear that love for one person is almost an absurd thing that would cause one to make the non-rational choice.
Yes.
In other words, the architect believes that the choice is between, well, if you save Trinity now, we're going to destroy the Matrix and everybody in it, and Trinity dies anyway. If you save everybody but 23 people, Trinity is still going to die, or maybe she could even be one of the 23 you save, but hey, at least you'll get 23 people out of that. But he makes this irrational choice to save her in the moment.
Yeah.
Which obviously is going to be what will ultimately save everybody at the end of the trilogy because that's what Neo is going to do. But
right. They've obviously set up Neo as different from the other ones that have come in the past. You know, the machines, and I think the architect know, and maybe the Oracle does to some degree as well, that that Neo is different from the rest of them. And what is, you know, I like it because I think it ties into the rave scene a lot. And I know that people make fun of that scene, but I actually really like it. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I really like about this movie is, well, there's a couple things. Number one, I like the fact that this is a very racially diverse cast.
Yes, that was one of the gender diverse and, too.
Yeah. And, you know, and actually it might be majority non-white. I don't know.
I think that, you know, that seemed the case, but yeah, which takes away a lot of undertones that, you know, would be there in a more monochromatic cast. Like, in other words, there are no racial tensions between any of the characters, which would be the case if there was just one city of people and, right, you know, everybody. But yeah, nobody is – I don't know. I did really like that.
It is. I mean, to a large degree, I think that, you know, I don't know how – I don't know what the Wachowskis' political philosophies are, and I don't know exactly what the political philosophies of the Matrix movies are. But it does seem to me in some degree to be socialist. You know, like, Zion is obviously a place where everybody works together. I don't think that they really have, you know, CEOs. I don't think that – you know, this seems to be a very controlled – this seems to be a very controlled economy. Everybody has a prescribed job. You know, the council is in control, but at the same time, they are. There seems to be a mix between the council and the religion of Zion as well.
Yeah, and what I will say about the council is that it's very clearly their council of elders.
Yes.
And that is one thing that they – I mean, because, you know, the first counselor that we see for the most part is an older white male. But then when you see the rest of the council, you know, there are white women and black men and –
Cornel West is a counselor.
Okay, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, like, but, you know who Cornel West
is.
Yeah.
No, I didn't know he had a cameo. But yeah, then that's very deliberate to say that, you know, the only thing which, you know, yes, they want a certain amount of age and experience, which I can get behind. But other than that, yeah, it's not based on a single class or race or anything.
Yes, I think so. And the other part of that, too, I think is, you know, I don't think that there's any... I don't think they're making any points about Neo being white. I don't think they're really making any.
No.
I just think he happens to be white.
There, I mean, I would say yes, there probably is some kind of Hollywood, you know, rule about, well, the, you know, he's the leading man. But at the same time, because every single other person in the cast is of, you know, whoever did the best job, you know, for example, yeah, his white, that's one of those areas where his whiteness doesn't, you know, it kind of... it makes it less important in a way that it would have if, for example, you know, he was, you know, he doesn't come up as the, you know, the great white savior because, you know, there are white underclass, there are white, you know, I don't know. Am I making sense?
No, you're making sense. But I think that also makes me think of, you know, one of the things that I wish this movie had maybe gone into a little more and maybe The Matrix Revolutions does. I don't know. I don't remember it very well. Is I think that there probably would be a very real social or cultural difference between people in Zion that were released from the Matrix and ones that were born there. You know, and I think that if you look at it and you say people that were released from the Matrix would have a lot of cultural and social assumptions and be products of a very different society than the people in Zion. So I don't know where that really you can take that. It's just one of those thoughts I have, which is kind of interesting, where, you know, it seems to me that Zion is a very obvious attempt to overcorrect the ways that in which the society of the Matrix works as well.
And I would say that, you know, to what I'm thinking on this is that given that they all have the same goal, they're able to put aside that difference. I mean, I think about the fact that in the first Matrix, for example, Tank was, you know, Zion born.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that meant he can't go into the Matrix, but he's an operator. He still has a very important role and he still has just as much of a significant part in, you know, humanity's greater goal, which is the dissolution of the Matrix. And so I think, you know, I would say that, you know, maybe after, you know, if they defeat the machines, you know, maybe there would be eventually. I don't know. I'm obviously... But,
well, I think, you know, the other interesting thing there as well, I think, is that, and that's why I come back to the rave scene again, because it seems to me that the characters that were born in the Matrix and that go back to the Matrix to sort of fight the war on that level almost feel disconnected from the quote unquote real world. You know, Neo, Trinity, Morpheus, you know, they all kind of seem a little bit absent sometimes. They seem very sort of unemotional. I think that they don't really feel like Zion is their place in a way.
Yeah.
And the people that were born in Zion, you know, if you watch the rave scene, and I think it is a very profound, you know, if you can say that the Matrix Revolution or the Matrix Reloaded has any sort of coherent sort of philosophy, I think it really is about the beauty of human connection and sort of the beauty of emotion and the beauty of physicality, you know, because they're obviously these are people that the Matrix doesn't seem like that bad of a place, honestly. I mean, it's you know, late 20th century, you know, Western world, and that has problems as well.
Yeah, but I mean, we are also not, you know, there is a degree to which we can't necessarily figure out how much of a, like, is the Matrix exactly the same as if we went back in time to 1999 and every single bit, or is it, you know, it takes place in this ambiguous city, you know, is it just a certain amount of area, you know, and it's just vaguely based on, you know, the real world culture, but, you know, for the most part, like, if you ask Neo at the beginning of the first movie, hey, let's go to England, is he going to say, what the fuck is England, you know?
It's true. I mean, it does – that's a good question. I mean, it does make me think maybe – I mean, obviously, there are billions and billions of humans because we see in the first movie just the fields of humans.
Yeah, yeah.
But it could be that there are – you know, 500,000 matrixes that are all the same city.
Yeah, exactly. Are we dealing with an instanced MMO, for example?
Right. I think that's an interesting question. I think it does. You know, it's, I think it's, you know, if that were the case, I think it would make the contrast with the only human city left, Zion, to be a much more, I think, profound one as well.
Yeah. Because, I mean, my one of my questions I thought at the end of the movie was, you know, when all of these buildings are blowing up, I'm like, what the hell is going to go in the newspaper the next day, you know, because there are just, you know, Joe and Jane Average, you know, who are just Matrix connected, you know, have nothing to do with anything, but know a building blew up, you know. So, yeah, if it's self-contained cities that aren't as extensive as the real world, well, you know, maybe that's, you know, they can just shut down that one city and not have to, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is. And I think it also brings up the fact that this is something that was hinted at in the previous movie with the children that were doing telekinesis. The idea that ghosts and aliens and I mean, Neo flying around like fucking Superman. Yeah. You know, what are people making of that? Like, I like the fact that the movie does have a sense of humor, I think. And the movie, it's not a funny movie and it's not a funny universe, but it does have sort of this wry sense of, I think, detachment from itself, and it is kind of an amusing thing to think that all of the sort of, you know, paranormal stuff in the universe is kind of glitches in the programming of the Matrix.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the Monica Bellucci character says that exactly. So does the Oracle. You know, that is one of the, you know, I thought that was kind of cute.
Yeah, no, it is. And I don't know. I think we should talk about the machines because obviously they are becoming a more important part of the story.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to make of them. I think that there's obviously they seem to be controls or checks on the Matrix, and it almost seems like the Oracle, I mean, the Oracle is not really controlled by anybody, but they let her go. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, it's once you...
Okay, so they have the concept of programs, and one of the things with which the movie hints at is that program is an incarnation of purpose.
Yeah.
They talk about how, you know, the Oracle says, oh, everything, you know, the way that tree moves has a program to it. The way that bird is has a program to it. Essentially, there is a need. A program is created to fill that need. And so, you know, this goes on with talking about, you know, how they talk about walking the path in the first movie about being the one. There is a difference between I am the one and I am acting as the one. In other words, the one program is not Zen is not a thing. Zen is a process. You know, the one is not a person. The one is a state of being. The Oracle is not a person. The Oracle is a series of actions.
Yeah.
So,
well, I don't know. I mean, I think that there is an implication that the Oracle and the Merovingian, I mean, this is a universe where artificial intelligence exists.
Well,
so
here's the thing. we have the concept of rogue programs who go to kind of transcend that programming. We see Agent Smith doing that over the course of these first two films. In the first movie, he is an agent of the Matrix designed to – he has no more free will than any of the other men in black that we see. All their entire purpose is –
who are all white, by the way.
Which is very deliberate. That's, yeah. I would say, one of the few things in which the character's race is very deliberate. They are very much playing on white is a default, white is ambiguous, white is
they all have the same hairstyle. Yeah. They all kind of look the same, yeah.
You have the Agent Smith character, the going from from the moment he takes out the earpiece in the first movie, and you know, he is beginning to evolve a personality outside of his programming. And frankly, at the end of the Matrix and at the beginning of Revolutions, he's freaking out about the fact that he has no purpose anymore. He's evolved beyond
Reloaded, you mean, not Revolutions.
Reloaded. Yes. He is going through an existential crisis, and it is only in becoming essentially a virus, which is very ironic considering his speech in the first movie.
Yeah.
Because at this point all he does is to self-replicate. And that has become his new purpose.
Yeah, and what does he want exactly? Because I think that the existence of Neo is important in this iteration of this battle. I think that the existence of Agent Smith is also important, yeah, in this iteration of this battle. Because I think that what the machines are realizing, or maybe they're not realizing, I don't know. And especially the architect, I think when Neo goes through that door that he doesn't think he's going to go through.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He doesn't really react to that, which I thought was interesting. But anyway, you know, there's a degree to which this is obviously something different is happening, and it is the existence of Neo, and it is also the existence of Agent Smith.
Yeah. And I mean, I would say previous incarnations of the Matrix had their Agent Smith who did not, you know, or I mean, there was no Agent Smith. It was just any random agent, you know.
Well, the thing about Agent Smith now, though, is that he's not acting as an agent.
No.
He's not acting as...
And he's the only agent who has a name. And yes, it's an ironically bland name. But, I mean, that's even very deliberate. He is taking anonymity and using anonymity as his identity.
But absolutely. But I wonder what he wants, and I don't think that the movie answers it. I don't know if the Matrix Revolutions answers that question.
Well, I think it's hinted again, given that
is he just fixated on Neo? I mean,
given that the Oracle says, you know, what do men with power want? They want more power. That's part of what Smith wants. Again, he's become a virus whose whole purpose is to self-replicate. I really think that he considers Neo the antibody.
Yeah, that could be. And I wonder if Agent Smith – I mean, I don't think that the character has a coherent philosophy.
Yeah.
I don't think that he really thinks about anything that deeply. But at the same time, he may be – I mean, he's obviously fixated on Neo because Neo is the one that, in a sense, reprogrammed,
yeah,
him. And in his death, he's – I mean, you know, if we want to get really literal about it, Neo – I mean, at the very end of the movie, Neo brings Trinity back to life. He's the one who destroyed and killed Agent Smith at the end of the first movie. And now – and then, of course, through that action, Agent Smith has come back to life,
yeah,
as an agent of – I don't know what, chaos or something. And at the same time, Neo then brings Trinity back to life at the end of the movie, showing that he's able to – he may be the first one that's able to rewrite the Matrix, in a sense.
Yeah.
So if you look at Agent Smith, and especially in that battle scene with him and Neo, where there's just so many Agent Smiths going by, and yeah, again, it's a little too long. But
you know, I will say the movie had no restraint. That was one of the few scenes where I appreciated its lack of restraint because, you know, they took it to the logical conclusion. All right, you know, there's going to be not just five Agent Smiths, not a dozen Agent Smiths, but hundreds and thousands of Agent Smiths. Like
I think that scene was also very important, yeah, to show exactly how strong Neo is because,
yeah,
he's able to get away from 500 Agent Smiths, yeah, without really worrying about it that much.
Yeah.
And I think that the only, you know, and he, but I think at the same time, in the same way that Agent Smith is losing himself in this sort of you know, he's almost like Ahab in the White Whale. Yeah. Neo is his White Whale, and Neo is also losing himself in that. I mean, he only escapes from that battle when Trinity whispers in his ear, get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
And I think he's suddenly reminded of where he is and what his real purpose is. It's not to destroy Agent Smith. It's to destroy the Matrix.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, you get the sense that, well, here, in the first Matrix, Smith has that conversation with, oh my God, I hate it here. I hate this. You know, he wants to get out of the Matrix. He hates being there. And in a way, by evolving beyond and going rogue, you know, they talk about a rogue program is either hunted down and destroyed by agents or lives as an exile. And that's at the point where Smith is. And Smith wants to continue existing. And the Matrix is his host at this point. So Smith actually probably does want the Matrix to continue.
Because that's where he lives and that's where he exists. Yeah. You know, I think that if you look at this and you say, I mean, okay, we could extrapolate out the sort of nature of the machines, right? And I think that obviously there are, you know, machines that exist in the real world. We see the Seekers, or are they called Seekers? Or
Squids or something.
Something like that, yeah.
But they're very insectile and or creepy, you know.
Right. And then so we know that they're – and I don't know if they're supposed to be sentient life forms or what, but we do know that there are machines, many, many machines that exist in the real world because humans are using them as power or they're using humans as power. And then at the same time, we know that there are AIs that exist only as code in the Matrix.
Yeah, and here's my other question. Are there machines that, like, are there civilian machines, you know? Is there...
I think that that's probably the wrong question to ask. I think that the nature of the machine society seems to be some sort of cooperative fascism. You know, it's almost like an ant colony or something, you know, where there really is no... I don't know that the machines have individual personalities. I mean, maybe that's why the rogue AIs are so rogue, because they are emergent intelligences that create their own personalities to a certain degree, I think.
Okay.
I don't know, because I think that the agents don't have personalities, and I think that you know, Agent Smith doesn't really develop a personality until Neo kills him.
Yeah.
And he becomes something else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I feel like this is one of those things where I'm enjoying it more talking about it. I will say this at this point.
Yeah.
Like, it's weird that the, you know, and this is, I guess, part of the reason why, like, it does break my heart that there isn't the hour and a half version of this, because, you know, I don't really have that much to say about the action sequences. Like,
again, you've got iMovie. You could make one.
I could.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Good for me. The freeway sequence, it looked cool. These were a fine series of, you know, it looked almost like music videos for music I didn't like, but, you know.
Well, I think the action sequences, you know, we talked about them a little bit before, but I think that one of the things about the action sequences in this movie, of course, is that they're much bigger than the first movie.
Yeah.
This movie obviously had much more of a budget than the first one. I don't think the first one was a cheap movie by
any means. No, and also, let's put it this way, they had, you know, more, you know, they'd gotten more skilled at this point, you know.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you're talking about 4 or 5 years later. So.
Yeah, technology got better. They made the first movie, figured out some things already. You know, the first movie, they had to invent bullet time. The second movie, they were able to do a lot more with it, for example.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's interesting about the action sequences is, I think, their scale, but also they sort of act as punctuation marks, I think, in the movie. Because... If you take this movie to be sort of episodic, I think that it's not as episodic as something like Star Wars, but it definitely does have sort of the action sequences sort of end or maybe begin scenes as well, but they definitely act as a bridge between sections of the movie.
Yeah, in a way, you know, you have a... And I guess maybe if the balance had been a little better, maybe that was it. Maybe it felt very imbalanced, because I could see a movie that's kind of, you know... Action sequence, you know, talky philosophical scene, action sequence, talky philosophical scene. Like, that kind of a structure, you know, if it had been a little more, you know, balanced, would be good, because, you know, that way, all right, well, this is not, you know, Waking Life. You know, we aren't just going to sit for 2 hours and have people talk. But at the same time, this is something a little more than just watching people beat each other up.
Yeah, and I don't know to what degree the philosophical parts of this movie would hold together as well if it was 2 hours of dry discussion.
And they wouldn't, no. Again, you know, we talked last week about this is a lot of 101 versions of these concepts. You know, maybe this is a 102 class now, and, you know, it's certainly developing, you know, some of the ideas from the first movie, but this is still, you know, a summary of stuff that you would read for real, you know, in more sophisticated philosophy texts.
Yeah, because I don't think that the point of the Matrix movies are the ideas contained within. I think that they are an important part of it. And I think that the Wachowskis obviously have a lot of things that they want to say about these ideas. At the same time, I really do get a sort of Quentin Tarantino vibe, especially from this one, where they are really mashing up a bunch of different styles of movies, of philosophies of movies and filmmaking. And I mean, you've got sort of Western tropes in here. You've got sort of you know, martial arts tropes. You've got action movie tropes. You have sort of, you know,
a lot of science fiction
tropes in here. And they all sort of, I think it comes together pretty well. I think the movie hangs together pretty well. But I think that the action sequences do serve a purpose.
I mean, they do care about the action sequences as much as they care about the philosophical sequences, I would
and
say.
I will say they're fun to watch. I mean, in the same way that a musical is fun to watch. Like, yeah, maybe they're a little bit too long. I think that if you have a musical sequence in a musical that goes on for 15 minutes, like you do with these action sequences, that would be a little much. But
yeah, that's the whole thing. Like, I liked it, and after a while, I was full. You know, I can eat one piece of chocolate cake. I may even be able to eat two pieces, but five pieces is just way too many.
I think they did try to make the action sequences as different as they could. I mean, you definitely have your big set pieces. You have Neo fighting all the different Agent Smiths. You have Neo fighting the guys with the axes.
It is a very set piecey movie.
Maces. You have the big, you know, it is. Yeah, you have the big, probably the biggest action sequence, of course, is the one on the highway.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're all very well done, and I think they're all very choreographed very well, and there is an artistry to them. And, you know, the special effects are I think, restrained enough. I think that, you know, when we talked about The Matrix last week, we sort of compared it to the Star Wars prequels where, you know, part of the problem with that CGI is that there was no context for anything that was going on. And this very much has context. This very much is using CGI in service of, you know, a very artistic form of action filmmaking.
And it does, I mean, it's not for nothing. It does help that a lot of the CGI is just used for non-organic things. You know, aliens and CGI look a little more cartoony. Seeing the machines going and attacking, you know, number one, texturally it's a lot easier to do something metal, and it looks uncanny, and it works for that. You know, the fact that it is supposed to seem almost like a abomination that's slightly off is, you know, not unintentional. It certainly works with that.
Yeah. At the same time, though, I mean, obviously, I think most of Zion is CGI. And
yeah.
I think that works pretty well. You know, and so I think that you know, CGI is one of those things that if you get the shininess away from it, it can look pretty good.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe we should talk about Zion because we haven't talked about Zion that much.
I guess what the weirdest part about Zion was for me is that scene when, you know, they get off the elevator and there's all these people out there and, you know, they're giving him offerings and stuff. And number one, Neo doesn't really see – Neo kind of accepts it. The only thing he's upset about is that he doesn't get to bone Trinity right then, you know, which I can't blame him, you know.
I mean, but I can, but I don't like women, so.
I like Carrie Ann Moss. She has a very angular face.
I like women fine.
No, but like, I don't know. That was a weird scene. Who are those people? So are they – are they different from the – I mean, we certainly – they're certainly not on the soldiering class that we see, you know, because we see – you know, most of the characters are from that or are related to that or whatever. But yeah, who are they?
I think that they're just denizens of Zion.
Is it?
And
yeah. Is it?
They have their jobs, you know, and they do their jobs. I mean, I think that there is a civilian class in Zion.
I guess my question is, I found it weird that Neo accepts being Jesus kind of easily. And I don't know if that's for anything other than,
well,
most movies, you know, have the character angst about being the chosen one a little more than this does. Certainly Neo has his worries, but they're more tactical.
Well, I think there's two things going on there. I think, first of all, this is a movie specifically that delves a lot more into the whole prophecy and the mythology and the religion of the humans of this age, right? And the other thing, of course, I think is that Neo, he doesn't really react to much. He's a very controlled person. What would you say the personality of Neo is?
Yeah, I know. The scene in The Architects when, you know, all of the different versions of him are freaking out and laughing and flipping him off, like, that was the most personality Neo has. And I, frankly, part of the reason that I liked that scene is because, I don't know, it was Neo letting his hair down for a moment.
And yeah, well, I think
– I don't – yeah, that's my question. Is Neo just deliberately restraining himself because if he lets the facade crack, everything's suddenly going to come pouring out? Or does he just not have that much depth?
I think it could be that he just doesn't have much depth. And I also think it could be that the movie doesn't deal with it because that's not the story that the movie wants to tell.
It's true. I mean, if you read the Bible, what's Jesus' personality?
Right. Like,
you know,
they're
what is the personality of Siddhartha Gautama? You know, they don't – that's not their point.
Point, right. And I also think that there is – it's funny because the movie is sort of tautological in a way because it is very cyclical and it is saying that these things are happening because these things have always happened. At the same time, it is very much about choice, and it is very much about Neo breaking this cycle. And maybe the way that Neo is breaking this cycle is just accepting everything except the thing he can't accept.
Well, because, you know, again, breaking the cycle is one of the tenets of Buddhism, and one of the ways is, you know.
And we also do see Buddhists in this movie, interestingly enough.
Do we?
Yeah, there are some guys that are dressed in typical, you know, Buddhist robes.
No, I mean, I didn't notice it, but
you don't notice much.
So. I don't. I'm a very shallow person. You know, the condition of humanity is suffering. The cause of suffering is desire. The way to get over desire is to remove oneself from attachments. And so there's a concept of the Bodhisattva, who is somebody who has attained nirvana in their life, but comes back, you know, to earth in order to help people escape it. That's a very obvious, you know, what the people who are going, you know, the people who leave the Matrix and come back, you know, in order to perform missions. That's very obviously who, you know, an analog of that. But in a way, the choosing the door that keeps the 23 people and, you know, because we need to keep humanity, that's attachment to humanity. And ironically enough, because of his attachment to Trinity, maybe it just doesn't really add up because maybe it shouldn't be looked at in this angle, but that's where I don't know.
No, I think there's something to that, but I also think that you have to look at his choice in the end of the movie to go through the door that may destroy all of humanity and cause them to go extinct is that Neo is the choice to save 23 people and then slowly rebuild, you know, Zion again and have this cycle and have the release valve of Zion and all this kind of stuff. That's actually not a choice because he's making a decision for people. And I think at the end of the movie, I don't know if Neo is consciously aware of this or not, but I think what he's doing is he is rejecting that as a false dichotomy. He's rejecting the cycle, and he is saying it is up to everybody, not just me, to break the cycle, I think it will work. I don't think that the Matrix Revolutions is going to end with the destruction of and the extinction of humanity. But
no, but yeah, that's true. Maybe his love for Trinity in the moment is, but eventually his desire is to stop the cycle.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then what does that mean for Agent Smith, who is now able to send his personality out into the real world?
Well, yeah, what does that mean for?
I don't know that it means anything.
Well, we'll find out in the next
We'll find out in the next movie, probably. But I think that maybe the only thing you can take away from that is the movie is very clearly making an equivalency between machine and human intelligence to a certain degree.
Oh, I think that's, you know, true. And I mean, what I've read about the Animatrix, you know, and I know a couple of them deal with, you know, the initial war. And, you know, it talks about, you know, there are sketches that show you know, how poorly the machines were treated. You know, this is a case of, you know, this is one of those cases where we have cycles of dominance. We have, you know, one group at the top and, you know, oppressing another, that group, you know, goes to rise against their oppressors but becomes oppressors themselves. And I mean, that ultimately is the true destructive cycle. The goal, at least in my, you know, worldview and my personal philosophy, is figuring out ways of transcending that conflict. And I mean, I know it's interesting that, you know, as we said, you know, Zion is very racially diverse, you know, and, you know, they wouldn't have, you know, that we all need to think of ourselves as human because it's us against the machines. I hope that the movie does end in a way that, you know, again, does view them as equivalents. And how do we coexist? Exactly.
I think you're right. I think that that's kind of where I think this is going. Again, yeah. I've seen The Matrix Revolutions, but I don't remember it very well because I think I saw it once, yeah, you know, 12 years ago or whatever. But, you know, I think that it is a case of I think that rejecting the cycle is also rejecting the idea that for the humans to win, all the machines have to die.
Yes.
And I use that word very deliberately, too, because, yeah, you know, you think back to that conversation that Neo has with the counselor. Where the counselor's talking, you know, talking about, and it's kind of a funny scene because, of course, he's saying old men don't have to make points. They just ramble on.
Yeah.
But, you know, he knows what he's doing.
And by the way, having seen, you know, the Star Wars prequels recently, I'm like, don't trust him.
He's the emperor. He's Darth Sidious. I think that when he's talking about the machines and what does it mean to have machines, and, you know, these don't have AI, obviously. These are just machines that we've built. But, you know, Neo says, oh, well, we could destroy them. And then the counselor's like, yeah, but then we wouldn't have any air. We wouldn't have any water. You know, so are we dependent on the machines or are the machines dependent on us? And I think that's the central question of the entire trilogy, perhaps.
Yeah. And I guess one of the other, you know, there is a difference between, you know, the machines that, you know, they're pointing at and the machines that took over, you know, because and I think, you know, that this is going into some Doug Hofstadter ideas, but there is the concept of,
I really like his music, by the way.
Good. He's an AI researcher, wrote a lot of very weird books on it that I love. He's great. But, you know, he talks about AI as an emergent behavior of a system. When a system becomes self-referential enough, a self and a consciousness begins to grow. And the metaphor he uses is of, like, the sizes of souls. And he says, you know, a mosquito, you know, doesn't really have a soul as far as we think about it. We can swat one without feeling like, you know, we're killing something. You know, if we were to kill a cat that was annoying us, you know, we would find that cruel, for example. And he talks about how it's, you know, a scaling thing. You know, all right, so you feel like, you know, mosquitoes do have souls. There is some kind of error, you know, does a bacteria, for example. You know, there is a kind of too small to, you know, worry about. And in a way, the machines that are just powering Zion are just dumb machines that, you know, maybe don't. And maybe the, you know, concept is that, yes, you can, you know, because I don't think anybody in, you know, the Matrix isn't going to the, you know, thing that, you know, technology is bad. You know, it certainly isn't the case. But,
no, yeah,
you know, oppressing a soul, caging a soul in, taking away that soul's freedom, that's the sin, that's the problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can have a machine that doesn't think, that's okay, but when you have a machine that does think, you know, the right thing to do is let that machine think for itself and choose its own path.
Sure. Yeah, because I think that one of the things that I think the movie may be going down the road of is obviously saying that there needs to be more of an equivalency between the machines and the humans, but also that this idea that for one to survive, the other has to be enslaved or die is a false choice.
Yeah.
And also that there is a beauty to the machines, and there is a sense that, you know, the machines may have overcorrected. The machines may have been very sort of fascistic in their ways in which they deal with human beings. And there is a sense that, you know, we shouldn't treat the machines the way the machines have treated us.
Yeah. You know, at some point, somebody needs to sob and say, look, I don't care who started it. I'm going to finish it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think maybe Neo taking that, you know, that's kind of Neo's choice at the end. At the end, he's saying, look, I don't give a shit anymore. We're ending this. This is done.
And but what does it mean at the end of the movie when Neo now has the ability to turn off the machines in the real world?
Oh, yeah, that is like, a good question.
There is a certain degree to which I kind of like the fact that the movie doesn't really explain this stuff. I mean,
well, that's the big cliffhanger of it, really.
Yeah, but it's almost magical. You know, yeah. It's kind of, I don't know. It I don't know that it obviously matters for the actual tactical ability for Zion to fight back against the machines, but I don't know what it means in terms of the philosophy of the movie.
Yeah, I don't know. I
guess that will be dealt with.
I was going to say, I feel like it's the kind of thing that, you know, they introduce it in the last 5 minutes of the movie, if that, you know, it's kind of one of the last, you know, Neo has these powers and he's in a coma and suddenly, you know, what's his name, you know, is all Agent Smith'd. And, you know, there has been a big blow to Zion.
Right. And so that's kind of the end of the movie. I also think that you know, in terms of Neo's powers kind of going into the real world to some degree, you know, we haven't really talked that much about Morpheus, which I think is interesting because Morpheus was one of the more interesting and singular characters and presences in the original Matrix. And in this movie, he's kind of sidelined. You know, he's not as important. He's kind of just the crazy guy who no one really believes this prophecy, but he's the one who's championing it. And he doesn't want to believe that the prophecy was created by the machines to act as another way in which they can control humanity. And at a certain point, it doesn't really matter. I think that what he's, you know, maybe they'll deal with this in the next one, I don't know. But I do find Morpheus interesting in this movie because he is very much a believer in Neo. He's very much a believer in this prophecy. And it is something that, to a certain degree, in the same way that Neo is rejecting the cycle, is rejecting the choice, you know, Morpheus is also rejecting the idea that the machines have agency over what they've created in a way. Mm. You know, it's a choice. Yeah, you may have, it's kind of like a parental thing in a way. You know, it's kind of like, you know, you grow up and you become your own person. And yeah, your parents will instill in you their beliefs and values, but you can make your own choices and synthesize or reject them as you will. And I think that that's kind of where Morpheus is going in this movie a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, there's also religious, you know, undertones to that. Again, this is a movie that very much, you know, thinks that religion is cool in a way, like, or at least the trappings of it as mythology.
I think that this, I don't know that I would say that the movie thinks religion is cool. I think that the movie respects religion and respects religious knowledge.
Again, you know, yeah, I would say
the ways in which religion deals with the real world.
Yeah, because it's not a theological thing. I mean, aren't, you know.
I don't get a sense that there's any sort of organized religion, really.
I don't think that there's a sense of a concept of God, for example. I mean, we're told, you know, the counselor is going to open the meeting with a prayer. But the prayer that he has isn't quite a religious prayer. It's more just a rousing speech.
Yeah.
You know, it's talking about some New Age humanist, you know, general idea.
It's almost a joke about, like, sort of, you know, Quakers or New Age religion or something, you know.
But at the same time, you know, there is a, you know, it respects religious mythology. It respects the concept of it, you know, because the concept of prophecies and chosen ones and, you know, there is a ritualness to that dance, something very, you know, you know, it does. I mean, frankly, it does make a lot of sense that they would have a lot of very sexually charged rituals because, you know, they need to repopulate humanity very quickly. But
also, God, how bad would that room
place
smell?
You know, it's after, you know, I feel like that's not the worst smelling thing in Matrix land.
Probably not.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to see where the next one goes. And I think that if the next one can hang on to the idea that humanity is sort of expansive and the sort of human, you know, desire knowledge of the world and the way we experience the world and the sort of sensuality of the physical world.
You know, that's one other thing I wanted to definitely mention is there's this concept of belief exists of things existing whether or not you believe in them. Like at one point, you know, someone says to Morpheus, you know, look, I don't share your beliefs. And he says, you know, my beliefs don't require me to. And, you know,
or require you to.
Don't require you to. And the the Harold Perrineau character, you know, Michael from Lost or Augustus Hill.
What's his name?
Harold Perrineau.
Yeah, no, but the character's
name. Oh, Link.
Name. Link,
yeah. Yeah, at one point, you know, when his wife gives him, you know, that necklace and, you know, as a good luck charm and, you know, he doesn't really believe in it and, you know, she's like, oh, give it, you know, take it anyway. You know, he puts it on like, oh, it doesn't really, you know, can't hurt, you know. He is, you know, that's another, you know, little example of that, you know. Yes, it's whether or not he believes in it, it's irrelevant, you know, it's... you know, a symbol of her wishing him protection.
Right, exactly. It's important to someone that he loves and cares about. Yeah. And so in that sense, it's imbued with almost mystical qualities on that basis.
Well, what this reminds me of, because last week, you know, you were talking about, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson and, you know, how you, you know, find that whole nitpickiness. And I remember a quote of his, what is it, reality is what exists whether or not you believe in it, that thing. I think it's really interesting that same sentiment used to a religious prophecy in this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think you're right. And you know, also, I think it's interesting because I'm, you know, this is kind of a side point, but I'm reading this book about traffic now. And one of the things that's been really interesting in the book, and it's one of those sort of pop social psychology books about, you know, taking all this sort of knowledge and kind of synthesizing it into a way that the average person can understand in an entertaining way. But one of the things that the points he keeps making and going back to in the book is that, you know, human vision was not designed to be traveling at 60 miles an hour. And so in a very real sense, the ways in which we construct the built environment for drivers is designed in a way in which to create an illusion of safety and things that we can see. You know, something like the fact that most of the lines on a highway are actually like 25 feet long, for example.
Yeah.
And we don't realize it because our eyes are not attuned to that. The whole convex thing about how things that are far away. Or, you know. And so I think that that's kind of the same way where that whole Neil deGrasse Tyson thing about reality is what exists, whether you believe it or not. It's like, yeah, maybe, but also I think that you have to recognize that what you're seeing and what you're hearing and what you're believing is, you know, may not be the objective reality. And I think
it's that whole thing with, you know, six blind people touch an elephant, you know, and they each think it's something different based on, you know, that there is an objective reality, you know, there, but, you know, our perspectives may be limited and, you know, we may not quite understand it all. And so,
and I'm also, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of coming around to the idea that there may not be an objective reality. You know, like if there is alien, I mean, this is kind of going off on a tangent now, but if there is alien species out there that experience the universe in very different and profound ways than we do, you know, to a certain degree, you know, I can look at this desk and I can say, oh, it's gray and, you know, it's this hardness and all that kind of stuff. But there could be another ways in which, you know, you experience the world that are totally different.
You know, there is a degree to which, you know, size determines perception. I mean, you and I know academically that, you know, the desk and us are made out of molecules, for example, and made out of atoms and stuff. And, you know, the scene where he reaches and restarts her cart and everything turns into code, for example, reminded me of, like, yes, in between the molecules that make up my body, there is gigantic amounts of space, you know, in between. Again, as with the desk, but my hand won't pass through because, that's not the level on which, you know, we understand reality to be. So, yes, I can understand. I can imagine of another perception of the world which views it on a lower level or a higher level, for example.
Well, and to wrap this conversation around back to the Matrix and the sort of difference between the machines and the humans is that the machines and the humans obviously interact with the world in very different ways. And I think that I think the movie is coming down on the side that they're both valid. And I also think it's interesting that Neo is the only character that we see his perception of what the Matrix looks like. And that's obviously a sop to the audience. It doesn't really look like that. Code does not actually form in the shape of things, but
it's a
visual metaphor,
and it looks cool.
So,
I mean, we also see plenty of other characters who, you know, can look at the monitor, and, you know, I mean, that's with what's his name in the first movie. We see Link doing that in this. You know, people can look at code and understand what's going on in the Matrix.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and but that's like, you know, I mean, there are people who, you know, we'll use an electron microscope or whatever and, you know, be able to see the world on a molecular basis and can understand it on that better than we can. But it still means that in their everyday, when they are eating and eating dinner and, you know, going to work, you know, they are still thinking on the same level of reality more or less than we do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it'll be interesting to see where this wraps up next week. Well, if you would like to share your thoughts on this episode of the podcast, please leave a comment on the post for this episode at trekaboutshow.com. Please give us some money, patreon.com/trekaboutshow. You can support the show. We really do appreciate all of our loyal patrons, and there are some cool perks there that you can get if you give us some money. Our social media username, where you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, is trekaboutshow. And as always, please leave us a positive iTunes review for Trek About Presents. If you leave us one, we will read it on the show. Next week, we wrap up this season of Trek About Presents.
Oh my God.
By talking about the final movie in the Matrix trilogy, The Matrix Revolutions. What is going to happen?
Well, they're
going to
have a revolution.
They win. Sorry, Richard, I spoiled it.
You asshole.